At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
As Washington talks gun control, out in the real world, it's pure gun economics. Too much demand, not enough supply. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 17th of January. Good to have you with us. So now that the White House has rolled out its gun control proposals and gun rights groups have started pushing back against them, there is a certain amount of waiting around that's going to happen. Congressional hearings, lobbying, ads and counter ads, you know how it goes. But for some people, this is an everyday issue. Just after Christmas, we talked to a gun dealer out in Wyoming. Frank Gerstenkorn is his name. He's in Cheyenne. And we asked him about how he sees things. We dialed him back up on this day after the president's proposals to check back in. Mr. Gerstenkorn, it's good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
We talked to you last right after Christmas, not long after the Newtown shootings. You said business was good. It was brisk, I think, is what you said. Is it still that way?
It moved from being brisk to being a storm.
Really?
Well, yesterday was incredible. Because of the announcements, I think it caused some new interest. And that's not to say that the interest has not been high since I spoke with you last.
What kind of inventory are you moving this week, Mr. Gerstenkorn?
Just about anything I can get through the door. There will be no black guns sold because we can't get any of them.
I'm sorry, what's a black gun?
The black guns are the paramilitary guns, the AR-15s.
Gotcha. You can't get your hands on them to sell them?
There are none in the warehouses.
Wow. So you've been watching and you've been in the gun business for a long time, Mr. Gerstenkorn. And one of the things we're trying to get a sense of is how business in the gun industry changes as public attention gets paid to it after one of these shootings or one of these decisions by Washington, and how maybe it stays the same.
One of the big changes is trying to engage in the scramble for product to sell. Literally everything we get through the door goes right back out. Some of the guns that we have had come in the store never even got on the shelves. They were sold as they came through the door.
This is going to sound insensitive at best, but you're making a lot of money on this, aren't you?
We haven't done what I've seen happen in other parts of the country, and that is we haven't boosted our prices at all. We have a customer base here that we consider our friends. They're almost like family. I couldn't look any one of them in the eye if I thought I had cheated them.
At the end of the day then, Mr. Gerstenkorn, what has all of the past, month, 5 weeks since Newtown meant for you as a guy who is a federally licensed weapons dealer?
Well, it causes me concern about whether or not I'm going to be in this kind of business at the extent I've been in for a while, Does it tell me that I'm probably going to have to close my doors? I doubt it. Have we downsized in anticipation of this? Yeah, we have downsized staffing. We have the equivalent of two full-time positions that are no longer here.
Yeah, but you're still in business, and for now, doing good business.
It's been remarkable for the last month or so, but as we run out of product, that'll go away too.
Frank Gerstenkorn is in Cheyenne, Wyoming. He runs a gun shop there. It's called Guns and Gear. Mr. Gerstenkorn, thank you for your time, sir.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you calling.
Traders shook off the case of the blahs they've had the past couple of days, sent all three major indices higher on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We learned today mortgage rates are inching their way back down to historic lows, a mere 3.38% for the average 30-year home loan. Those low rates have, as you might imagine, sparked something of a refinancing boom. But, and here's the twist, it's not just homeowners. There's another kind of loan refi out there that's seeing a boost as well. Drivers may be sticking with their cars longer, but they're trading in for shiny new loans, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
A couple of years ago, Inkster, Michigan resident Linda Wasson fell victim to the hard sell.
I went in just to look at a car, and I was at that dealership about 6 hours because it was like they were so determined to get me this car.
And the five-year loan that went with it that had an interest rate of 21.2%. Wasson kept up with her payments, her credit score improved, and she was able to refinance, dropping her interest rate from 21.2% to 4.2%.
My car payment went from $660 a month to $483 a month, which to me is a big saving.
It's mind-boggling when you look at that. It just makes you angry at the other lenders.
Hank Hubbard is the president of Communicating Arts Credit Union in Detroit, which refinanced Wasson's car.
There are an awful lot of people that are paying the maximum rate that's allowed in Michigan, which is 25%.
Before the recession, about 14% of car buyers refinanced, says auto analyst Art Spinella, mostly subprime borrowers like Wasson.
During the recession, no one was willing to refinance a car loan. And now we're starting to see that market coming back.
And big financial institutions like Chase and Capital One are aggressively moving into the business for good reason, says Spinella.
Auto loans are really very safe. The delinquency rate is less than 2%.
There's built-up demand from people like Linda Wasson, who realized her loan was going to make her $20,000 car cost a lot more.
I was going to end up paying like $40,000 for a 2010 Hyundai Sonata. That was just ridiculous.
Wasson's new loan will save her more than $10,000 in interest. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
You know how political Washington is having a hard time managing the American economy? Debt limit, fiscal cliff, sequester, I could go on. There is no small irony in that because politics brings no small boost to the Washington economy. And it starts with the fundamental act of American politics, a presidential inauguration. President Obama's first inauguration brought millions of people to the Capitol, many times that amount in dollars to the local economy. Hotels, restaurants, even street vendors cashed in. The crowds this coming weekend, though, aren't expected to be anywhere near as big, nor, it follows, is the economic impact. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
4 years ago, I was worried about how I would get to work on Inauguration Day. The city of Washington warned commuters not to drive. 5 months pregnant with my twin boys, I wedged myself into an overflowing Metro car. The crowd swept me off the train at my stop. We moved as a tidal wave down K Street, then filled side streets on our way to the National Mall. There we watched the inauguration on big screens, far from the action.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
There were seats available close to the front. Tickets for those seats were distributed by Congress and members of the Presidential Inaugural Committee for free. In 2009, some tickets were scalped for as much as $24,000.
The inauguration 4 years ago was like the Super Bowl on steroids.
That's Danny Matta. He owns GreatSeats.com. He's a ticket broker. The prices in 2009 were off the charts.
4 years ago, everything was double, triple what it is now.
By everything, Matta means inaugural tickets, tickets for the parade route and the inaugural balls, especially the ones the Obamas actually attended.
Now, as the first couple takes their first dance, please welcome Beyoncé.
This year, Matta says orders for tickets are just a fifth of what they were in 2009. Demand for Obama souvenirs has also tanked.
Yeah, we got the keychains, Obama keychains right here.
James White is a street vendor. His cart is just down the block from the White House. He's been selling T-shirts and trinkets here for 20 years. But the 2009 inauguration was his best ever.
It was a crazy, crazy money-making day. Buying, selling. Selling quick. People coming out, jumping out of cars. Hey, I want Obama T-shirts.
White says he could get $20 for an Obama T-shirt in 2009. Not this time around. He's slashed his T-shirt prices dramatically.
Three for $10. It's crazy.
Even Washington's high-end vendors are hurting. People who peddle hotel rooms, for example. 4 years ago, Washington's hotels were almost totally booked, even though they were charging an average of $600 a night. This year, there are still rooms available, so hotels are offering perks to attract the well-heeled inaugural attendee. Elliot Ferguson is president of Destination DC, Washington's Convention and Visitors Bureau. He says one hotel is including a stipend for shopping at Saks Fifth Avenue in its inaugural package.
They basically give you a line of credit with your package to stay at that particular property that allows you to go and shop for your gowns for the balls and or whatever.
Some hotels have already started dropping prices. One has rooms available for $199 a night, an inaugural bargain that would have been unheard of 4 years ago. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, hope and a second chance.
In Los Angeles, we have a magical factory system of second acts. My father wandered into one of these places on Hollywood Boulevard. It was the night school at Hollywood High.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was a good day across the board. The Dow Industrials gained 84.6%, closed at 13,596. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ was up 18.6%, finished at 3136. The S&P 500 added 8 points, about a half percent, ended things at 1480. There was some more good news about housing today. Construction starts jumped 12%, and so among big home builders, Pulte Group put on a 5.3% increase. Toll Brothers rose 3.5%. D.R. Horton up 2.5% today. You ever wonder about all the billboards that say CBS on them? Yeah, it's the same company as the TV network. How about that? Now CBS is getting out of the billboard business, though its shares rose 8% today. European markets were up. The French CAC 40 gained nearly 1%. Back home, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.87%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. Feeling social? Visit NASA. It holds an open house at its headquarters in Washington, all part of inauguration activities. And it's Thesaurus Day, honoring or celebrating or observing the birthday of its author, Peter Mark Roget, on January 18, 1779. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you find yourself wondering what might possibly happen between now and whatever the end of the debt ceiling hullabaloo turns out to be, yeah, us too. Which is why we were so happy to see what Tim Fernholz had done over at Quartz. That's the Atlantic Magazine's business and economic site. He did a flowchart. If yes, this happens. If no, then that happens. It's a little bit like a choose-your-own-adventure novel. So we called him up and we asked him to come over and explain it to us. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Kai.
We will start at the beginning with a couple of steps which now honestly seem unlikely. One, you say there could be a consolidated bargain. There could be a deal.
The best possible outcome is that President Obama and Republicans in Congress get together and come up with a fiscal deal that cuts the deficit and they raise the debt ceiling as part of that.
We should say that does not seem likely.
That does not seem likely.
Option two, a concession to Republican demands from the White House.
Republicans would really like to just cut spending a lot in order to raise the debt limit. Don't think the Senate and I don't think President Obama are going to give into that, but that's one option. And if we cut spending that much, probably have a recession, certainly be on the back of a lot of seniors in Medicare, Social Security.
At least the debt ceiling will be taken care of.
We avoid a crisis.
All right. This next item is intriguing. You say he could option $2 trillion worth of public assets. What does that mean? Is that like selling the Brooklyn Bridge?
Pretty much. Assuming that Ben Bernanke of the Federal Reserve would go along with this, which he probably wouldn't if he wouldn't take the coin, President Obama could say, listen, I'm going to put an option on Alaska. To sell Alaska, give it to the Federal Reserve in exchange for a couple $1 trillion, pay all the bills, avoid the default.
You know, this is funny. I mean, people think this is outrageous on the face of it. But if you'll recall, 5-6 years ago, Ford did the same thing with everything it had, the Blue Oval, the whole shebang, which got it through the recession and all of that stuff without a bailout.
Sometimes in a crisis, you have to do crazy seeming things.
Okay. Here's one actually that a lot of people are exploring and is being taken somewhat seriously, prioritizing payments.
Exactly.
So that is what? Deciding who to pay?
Pretty much. So when February 15th rolls around that time and Treasury runs out of cash, they're going to have revenue coming in from taxes and other things, but not enough to pay the bills.
Yeah.
Hypothetically, the Treasury Secretary, the President could say, we're going to pay some people and not others. It may be illegal because Congress is supposed to do that. There's a legal opinion from 1985 that says it might be legal.
Oh, man.
But the bigger problem is it might be impossible to do because everything is running on antiquated computer systems and getting them all rejiggered to not automatically do these payments in time just might not be possible.
Say that one more time. We can't actually figure out who to pay and who not to pay?
If we could figure out who we wanted to pay, let's say we just picked 40% of the things the government's not going to do it, it might not be possible to change the computer systems and the way we actually do the payments in time to stop that money from going out.
Okay, so having done all of this analysis, what of all the many boxes and options and arrows and dotted lines on your flowchart, what's the most likely scenario? What's going to happen?
The most likely scenario is going to be, I think, sort of the classic Washington punt. Like we saw in 2011 with the fiscal cliff, or like we saw with the fiscal cliff and the fiscal cliff.
That sound you hear is the can being kicked down the road, and I apologize to everybody for using that phrase. Right?
Yeah.
And that's what it is.
Pretty much, but that wouldn't be such a bad thing. As long as you don't default on the U.S. debt, kicking the can in a measured way is pretty good.
All right, so let's skip on down to the bottom of this thing, the bottom of your flowchart, to the box that says there be dragons, as if we don't know what happens if we don't fix this thing. Can we really not know? Are you sure?
We really don't. It would be unprecedented for the U.S. to run out of cash and potentially default on its debt. And when that happens, the reactions in the market, the political reactions, what people on the street will think, it's hard to say. We would be in a whole new world. And just like the old explorers' maps when they didn't know where they were going,
there'd be dragons. Now I get it. Tim Fernholz, he writes for the Atlantic's new business website. It's called Quartz. Tim, thanks a bunch.
Pleasure to be here.
And I should say you can see his flowchart on our website. It's marketplace.org. The odds are really good. The odds are excellent, in fact. fact that somewhere in your use of the telecommunications infrastructure today, internet, telephone, what have you, whatever you were doing was touched somehow by a piece of equipment made by a Chinese company called Huawei. It is, in fact, the world's biggest telecommunications equipment company, which is making Congress nervous. Last year, a House committee urged U.S. companies not to do business with Huawei, saying that if it was allowed more access to the American market, the Chinese government would then be able to spy on us more easily. So Huawei did what any good capitalist enterprise would do. It launched a public relations campaign. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports now from the company's headquarters down in Shenzhen in South China.
Inside the research and development wing of Huawei's headquarters, engineers are testing equipment. When I enter the room, they stop what they're doing and look at me suspiciously. Above them, on the wall, big blue Chinese characters set the mood. My guide reads them out loud. Conduct yourself professionally, protect company secrets. For two decades, Huawei has done this well, perhaps too well. The company's CEO, Ren Zhengfei, is a former officer in China's military, and he's notoriously reclusive. The high-tech equipment the company makes is used, some say, to spy on people. Huawei has always managed to leave a trail of suspicion.
We have not done a good job at telling our story.
And that's why Scott Sykes and others in Huawei's PR team are now more willing to talk to foreign journalists. This tour is part of a charm offensive in the wake of a U.S. House committee report that essentially barred the company from doing business in the U.S. The report labeled Huawei a security threat.
It's not about security because we have world-proven equipment. So what is it about? I think one of the major things would probably be trade protectionism.
That view is shared by many members of the foreign business community here in China. They suspect the committee singled out Huawei just because it was Chinese. Sykes says the report gave no evidence that Huawei, a private company independent of China's government, should be seen as a threat.
Huawei is not China. Huawei is Huawei. We are an independent commercial company. 0% ownership by the Chinese government.
Huawei made $35 billion last year selling communications equipment to people in 140 countries. The company's hardware now connects a third of the world's population. Employees relax at one of the many espresso bars on Huawei's campus. The average age here is 29. They work inside a beautifully manicured campus where each section is defined by a different type of architecture, from neoclassical mansions to ancient Chinese courtyards. Huawei employs 140,000 people worldwide, nearly 2,000 in California. Half its workforce are engineers dedicated to high-tech research. As a result, Huawei is consistently among the top 5% of global companies in patent applications. Sykes says not allowing Huawei to compete in the U.S. hurts American consumers.
When we're allowed to participate in the bid, our competitors have to bring their best, most sophisticated, highest quality equipment in order to win.
But Huawei's biggest problem is that it's a telecommunications company from China. Peter Mattis is the editor of the China Brief at the Jamestown Foundation in Washington.
Most telecommunications firms have a relationship with the host, with their local government. You know, how else would a security service be able to do wiretapping or other types of communications monitoring? So in some sense, the question is, why would Huawei be exceptional from the rest of the world?
Huawei denies it would ever act on behalf of the Chinese government. Mattis isn't so sure.
The question is what happens in a crisis or when there's a high demand for a specific kind of service at a specific time to do specific things. I mean, would we expect that Huawei isn't staffed by patriotic Chinese citizens who, in a moment of crisis, wouldn't answer their government's call?
Huawei's Scott Sykes says no way. Nearly three-quarters of Huawei's revenue comes from business outside of China, says Sykes.
We would lose 70% of our revenue, or $24 billion last year. That's 70% of our revenue, like that, overnight. It would be corporate suicide, it would be foolish, and we would never, ever do that.
Ultimately, it may not matter to Huawei whether it's given the keys to the U.S. market. It's doing spectacular business elsewhere. In 2011, the last year on record, Huawei's revenue grew by a third in Europe. In the past year, it's opened up a research center in Finland and doubled staff in Great Britain. Jobs that won't be coming to the U.S. anytime soon. In Shenzhen, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
When President Obama took the oath of office 4 years ago, there was a single word floating around out there, a word that had been pretty much the theme of his long campaign, the idea that he'd been running on, hope, of course. A lot of things have changed in the country and the economy since then, including, perhaps, how people think about that word. So this week we're asking people whose job it is to use words what hope might mean right now. Here's journalist and author Hector Tobar.
Hope is living in a city of second chances. I know this because I was born and raised in L.A., the capital city of American second acts, a city where people come from Korea, from Louisiana, from El Salvador, and many other places in search of a second chance at freedom and prosperity. In Los Angeles, we have a magical factory system of second acts. My father wandered into one of these places on Hollywood Boulevard in 1962. He went in a 21-year-old Guatemalan busboy with a fourth-grade education and came out a fluent English speaker on his way to college. It was the night school at Hollywood High. Yes, there is poverty in Los Angeles, but we are not yet living and perhaps never will live in the kind of grim, hopeless landscape of Dickens. I know a young man who was shot and paralyzed a decade ago while stealing a case of beer from a liquor store. He was in a gang then, a tough teenager who later shot someone from his wheelchair. My friend, the paraplegic, was charged with assault, but spared jail time by a benevolent judge. This one act of benevolence led my friend to that other factory of second chances we call community college. And then to the next level of reinvention called the State University, where he eventually earned his master's degree in, of all things, medieval literature. These days, he teaches kids to write. In Los Angeles and its great sprawl of suburbs, this is not an unusual story. Go to your average continuation school, and you'll find at least two or three kids in every classroom who are about to slingshot themselves back into the regular education system. That's what hope is. Hope is living in a city of second chances.
Hector Tobar is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. You can read an excerpt of his most recent book. It's called The Barbarian Nurseries at our website. It's marketplace.org. We're doing a live show from Chicago tomorrow, by the way, the place where the hopes for the Obama presidency came from. And we're looking for the answer to a tricky question on Inauguration Weekend. What does it take to make it in America right now? We're going to be live video streaming that show as well at marketplace.org. And while you're there, check out all of our inauguration coverage. It's called The Next America.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, an aviation story that thankfully has nothing to do with Boeing 787s or battery fires or anything like that at all. American Airlines rolled out its new livery today. That's a fancy word for the paint scheme they use on planes. Here's another word, ugly. To quote one industry observer, the new logo looks like a seagull sticking its head out of a shower curtain. See it for yourself at our website, marketplace.org. All right, we're done. We got to go. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday. Today, the Dow jumped 84 points, about 0.6%. The NASDAQ gained 18 points, also 0.6%. The S&P 500 up 8 points, 0.5%. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Special thanks today to the staff here at WBEZ in Chicago. We're live right here again tomorrow for a special Inauguration Weekend look at what it takes to make it in America. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can be here for that. See you tomorrow. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.